The room was silent, except for the humming of the fans. They looked at him with a new concern.
"These are very serious charges, brother," two brothers said in unison. "Serious? I know they're serious. That's how come I brought them. This opportunist thinks that because he's got a little more education, he's better than anybody else. He's what Brother Jack calls a petty individualist."
He struck the conference table with his fists, his eyes showing small and round in his taut face. I wanted to punch that face. It no longer seemed real, but a mask behind which the real face was probably laughing, both at me and at the others. For he couldn't believe what he had said. It just wasn't possible. He was the plotter, and from the serious looks on the committee's faces, he was getting away with it. Now several brothers started to speak at once, and Brother Jack knocked for order.
"Brothers, please," Brother Jack said. "One at a time. What do you know about this article?" he said to me.
"Not very much," I said. "The editor of the magazine called to say he was sending a reporter up for an interview. The reporter asked a few questions and took a few pictures with a little camera. That's all I know."
"Did you give the reporter a prepared handout?"
"I gave her nothing except a few pieces of our official literature. I told her neither what to ask me nor what to write. I naturally tried to cooperate. If an article about me would help make friends for the movement, I felt it was my duty."
"Brothers, this thing was arranged," Restrom said. "I tell you, this opportunist had that reporter sent up there. He had her sent up, and he told her what to write."
"That's a contemptible lie," I said. "You know I tried to get them to interview Brother Clifton."
"Who's a lie?"
"You're a liar and a fat-mouthed scoundrel. You're a liar and no brother of mine."
"Now he's calling me names. Brothers, you heard him."
"Let's not lose our tempers," Brother Jack said calmly. "Brother Restrom, you've made serious charges. Can you prove them?"
"I can prove them. All you have to do is read the magazine and prove them for yourself."
"It will be read. And what else?"
"All you have to do is listen to the folks in Harlem. All they talk about is him. Never nothing about what the rest of us do. I tell you, brothers, this man constitutes a danger to the people of Harlem. He ought to be thrown out."
"That is for the committee to decide," Brother Jack said. Then to me, "And what have you to say in your defense, brother?"
"In my defense," I said, "nothing. I haven't anything to defend. I've tried to do my work, and if the brothers don't know that, then it's too late to tell them. I don't know what's behind this, but I haven't gotten around to controlling magazine writers, and I didn't realize that I was coming to stand trial either."
"This was not intended as a trial," Brother Jack said.
"If you're ever put on trial, and I hope you'll never be, you'll know it. Meantime, since this is an emergency, the committee asks that you leave the room while we read and discuss the questioned interview." I left the room and went into a vacant office, boiling with anger and disgust. Restrom had snatched me back to the South in the midst of one of the top Brotherhood committees, and I felt naked. I could have throttled him, forcing me to take part in a childish dispute before the others. Yet I had to fight him as I could, in terms he understood, even though we sounded like characters in a razor-slinging vaudeville skit. Perhaps I should mention the anonymous note, except that someone might take it to mean that I didn't have the full support of my district. If Clifton were here, he'd know how to handle this clown. Were they taking him seriously just because he was black? What was wrong with them anyway? Couldn't they see that they were dealing with a clown? But I would have gone to pieces had they laughed or even smiled, I thought. For they couldn't laugh at him without laughing at me as well. Yet if they had laughed, it would have been less unreal. Where the hell am I?
You can come in now,
a brother called to me. And I went out to hear the decision.
Well, Brother Jack said, we've read the article, brother, and we're happy to report that we found it harmless enough. True, it would have been better had more wordage been given to other members of the Harlem District, but we found no evidence that you had anything to do with that. Brother Restrom was mistaken.
His bland manner and the knowledge that they had wasted time to see the truth released the anger within me.
I'd say that he was criminally mistaken, I said.
Not criminal, overzealous, he said.
To me it seems both criminal and overzealous, I said.
No, brother, not criminal.
But he attacked my reputation.
Brother Jack smiled, only because he was sincere, brother. He was thinking of the good of the brotherhood.
But why slander me? I don't follow you, Brother Jack. I'm no enemy, as he well knows. I'm a brother, too, I said, seeing his smile.
The brotherhood has many enemies, and we must not be too harsh with brotherly mistakes. Then I saw the foolish, abashed expression on Restrum's face and relaxed. Very well, Brother Jack, I said. I suppose I should be glad you found me innocent. Concerning the magazine article, he said, stabbing the air with his finger. Something tensed in the back of my head. I got to my feet.
Concerning the article? You mean to say that you believe that other pipe dream? Is everyone reading Dick Tracy these days?
This is no matter of Dick Tracy, he snapped. The movement has many enemies.
So now I have become an enemy, I said. What's happened to everybody? You act as though none of you has any contact with me at all.
Jack looked at the table. Are you interested in our decision, brother?
Oh, yes, I said. Yes, I am. I'm interested in all manner of odd behavior. Who wouldn't be? When one wild man can make a roomful of what I'd come to regard as some of the best minds in the country take him seriously. Certainly I'm interested. Otherwise, I'd act like a sensible man and run out of here.
There were sounds of protest, and Brother Jack, his face red, rapped for order.
Perhaps I should address a few words to the brother, Brother McAfee said.
Go ahead, Brother Jack said thickly.
Brother, we understand how you feel, Brother McAfee said. But you must understand that the movement has many enemies. This is very true, and we are forced to think of the organization at the expense of our personal feelings. The Brotherhood is bigger than all of us. None of us as individuals count when its safety is questioned. And be assured that none of us have anything but goodwill toward you personally. Your work has been splendid. This is simply a matter of the safety of the organization. And it is our responsibility to make a thorough investigation of all such charges.
I felt suddenly empty. There was a logic in what he said, which I felt compelled to accept. They were wrong, but they had the obligation to discover their mistake. Let them go ahead. They'd find that none of the charges were true, and I'd be vindicated. What was all this obsession with enemies, anyway? I looked into their smoke-washed faces. Not since the beginning had I faced such serious doubts.
Up to now, I had felt a wholeness about my work and direction, such as I'd never known, not even in my mistaken college days. Brotherhood was something to which men could give themselves completely. That was its strength and my strength. And it was this sense of wholeness that guaranteed that it would change the course of history. This I had believed with all my being, but now, though still inwardly affirming that belief, I felt a blighting hurt which prevented me from trying further to defend myself.
I stood there silently, waiting their decision. Someone drummed his fingers against the table. I heard the dry leaf rustle of onion-skin papers.
"Be assured that you can depend upon the fairness and wisdom of the committee," Brother Tobit's voice drifted from the end of the table. But there was smoke between us, and I could barely see his face. "The committee has decided," Brother Jack began crisply, "that until all charges have been cleared, you are to have the choice of becoming inactive in Harlem or accepting an assignment downtown. In the latter case, you are to wind up your present assignment immediately."
I felt weak in my legs. "You mean I am to give up my work?"
"Unless you choose to serve the movement elsewhere."
"But can't you see?" I said, looking from face to face and seeing the blank finality in their eyes.
"Your assignment, should you decide to remain active," Brother Jack said, reaching for his gavel, "is to lecture downtown on the woman question." Suddenly I felt as though I had been spun like a top.
"The what?"
"The woman question. My pamphlet on the woman question in the United States will be your guide. And now, brothers," he said, his eyes sweeping around the table, "the meeting is adjourned."
I stood there, hearing the rapping of his gavel echoing in my ears, thinking, the woman question, and searching their faces for signs of amusement, listening to their voices for the slightest sound of suppressed laughter, stood there, fighting the sense that I had just been made the butt of an outrageous joke, and all the more so since their faces revealed no awareness. My mind fought desperately for acceptance. Nothing would change matters. They would shift me and investigate, and I, still believing, still bending to discipline, would have to accept their decision. Now was certainly no time for inactivity. Not just when I was beginning to approach some aspects of the organization about which I knew nothing, of higher committees and the leaders who never appeared, of the sympathizers and allies in groups that seemed far removed from our concerns, not at a time when all the secrets of power and authority still shrouded from me in mystery appeared on the way toward revelation. No. Despite my anger and disgust, my ambitions were too great to surrender so easily. Why should I restrict myself? Segregate myself? I was a spokesman. Why shouldn't I speak about women, or on any other subject? Nothing lay outside the scheme of our ideology. There was a policy on everything, and my main concern was to work my way ahead in the movement. I left the building still feeling as though I had been violently spun, but with optimism growing. Being removed from Harlem was a shock, but one which would hurt them as much as me, for I had learned that the clue to what Harlem wanted was what I wanted, and my value to the Brotherhood was no different from the value to me of my most useful contact. It depended upon my complete frankness and honesty in stating the community's hopes and hates, fears and desires. One spoke to the committee as well as to the community. No doubt it would work much the same downtown. The new assignment was a challenge and an opportunity for testing how much of what happened in Harlem was due to my own efforts and how much to the sheer eagerness of the people themselves. And after all, I told myself, the assignment was also proof of the committee's goodwill, for by selecting me to speak with its authority on a subject which elsewhere in our society I'd have found taboo, weren't they affirming their belief both in me and in the principles of brotherhood, proving that they drew no lines even when it came to women? They had to investigate the charges against me, but the assignment was their unsentimental affirmation that their belief in me was unbroken. I shivered in the hot street. I hadn't allowed the idea to take concrete form in my mind, but for a moment, I had almost allowed an old southern backwardness which I had thought dead to wreck my career. Leaving Harlem was not without its regrets, however, and I couldn't bring myself to say goodbye to anyone, not even to Brother Tarp or Clifton, not to mention the others upon whom I depended for information concerning the lowest groups in the community. I simply slipped my papers into my briefcase and left as though going downtown for a meeting. I went to my first lecture with a sense of excitement. The theme was a surefire guarantee of audience interest, and the rest was up to me. If only I were a foot taller and 100 pounds heavier, I could simply stand before them with a sign across my chest stating, I know all about them, and they'd be as awed as though I were the original boogeyman, somehow transformed and domesticated. I'd no more have to speak than Paul Robeson had to act. They'd simply thrill at the sight of me. And it went well enough. They made a success through their own enthusiasm, and the barrage of questions afterwards left no doubts in my mind. It was only after the meeting was breaking up that there came the developments which even my volatile suspicions hadn't allowed me to foresee. I was exchanging greetings with the audience when she appeared, the kind of woman who glows as though consciously acting a symbolic role of life and feminine fertility. Her problem, she said, had to do with certain aspects of our ideology. It's rather involved, really, she said with concern, and while I shouldn't care to take up your time, I have a feeling that you... No, oh no, not at all, I said, guiding her away from the others to stand near a partly uncoiled fire hose hanging beside the entrance. Not at all. But, brother, she said,
It's really so late, and you must be tired. My problem can wait until some other time.
I'm not that tired, I said. And if there's something bothering you, it's my duty to do what I can to clear it up.
But it's quite late, she said. Perhaps some evening when you're not busy, you'll drop in to see us. Then we could talk at greater length. Unless, of course.
Unless?
Unless, she smiled, I can induce you to stop by this evening. I might add that I serve a fair cup of coffee.
Then I'm at your service, I said, pushing open the door. Her apartment was located in one of the better sections of the city, and I must have revealed my surprise upon entering the spacious living room.
You can see, brother, the glow she gave the word was disturbing. It is really the spiritual values of brotherhood that interest me. Through no effort of my own, I have economic security and leisure. But what is that, really, when so much is wrong with the world? I mean, when there is no spiritual or emotional security and no justice.
She was slipping out of her coat now, looking earnestly into my face. And I thought, is she a Salvationist, a Puritan with reverse English? Remembering Brother Jack's private description of wealthy members who, he said, sought political salvation by contributing financially to the Brotherhood. She was going a little fast for me, and I looked at her gravely. I can see that you've thought deeply about this thing, I said.
I've tried, she said, and it's most perplexing. But make yourself comfortable while I put away my things.
She was a small, delicately plump woman with raven hair in which a thin streak of white had begun almost imperceptibly to show. And when she reappeared in the rich red of a hostess gown, she was so striking that I had to avert my somewhat startled eyes.
"What a beautiful room you have here," I said, looking across the rich cherry glow of furniture to see a life-sized painting of a nude, a pink Renoir. Other canvases were hung here and there, and the spacious walls seemed to flash alive with warm, pure color.
What does one say to all this, I thought, looking at an abstract fish of polished brass mounted on a piece of ebony.
I'm glad you find it pleasant, brother, she said. We like it ourselves, though I must say that Hubert finds so little time to enjoy it. He's much too busy.
Hubert, I said.
My husband. Unfortunately, he had to leave. He would have loved to have met you, but then he's always dashing off. Business, you know.
I suppose it's unavoidable, I said, with sudden discomfort.
Yes, it is, she said. But we're going to discuss brotherhood and ideology, aren't we?
And there was something about her voice and her smile that gave me a sense of both comfort and excitement. It was not merely the background of wealth and gracious living to which I was alien, but simply the being there with her and the sensed possibility of a heightened communication, as though the discordantly invisible and the conspicuously enigmatic were reaching a delicately balanced harmony. She's rich, but human, I thought, watching the smooth play of her relaxed hands. There are so many aspects to the movement, I said. Just where shall we start? Perhaps it's something that I'm unable to handle.
Oh, it's nothing that profound, she said. I'm sure you'll straighten out my little ideological twists and turns. But sit here on the sofa, brother. It's more comfortable.
I sat, seeing her go toward a door, the train of her gown trailing sensuously over the oriental carpet. Then she turned and smiled.
Perhaps you'd prefer wine or milk instead of coffee.
Wine, thank you, I said, finding the idea of milk strangely repulsive. This isn't at all what I expected, I thought. She returned with a tray holding two glasses and a decanter, placing them before us on a low cocktail table, and I could hear the wine trickle musically into the glasses, one of which she placed in front of me.
Here's to the movement, she said, raising her glass with smiling eyes.
To the movement, I said.
And to brotherhood.
And to brotherhood. This is very nice, I said, seeing her nearly closed eyes, her chin tilting upward toward me. But just what phase of our ideology should we discuss?
All of it, she said. I wish to embrace the whole of it. Life is so terribly empty and disorganized without it. I sincerely believe that only brotherhood offers any hope of making life worth living again. Oh, I know that it's too vast a philosophy to grasp immediately, as it were. Still, it's so vital and alive that one gets the feeling that one should at least make the try. Don't you agree?
Well, yes, I said. It's the most meaningful thing that I know.
Oh, I'm so pleased to have you agree with me. I suppose that's why I always thrill to hear you speak. Somehow you convey the great throbbing vitality of the movement. It's really amazing. You give me such a feeling of security. Although, she interrupted herself with a mysterious smile, I must confess that you also make me afraid.
Afraid? You can't mean that, I said.
Really, she repeated as I laughed. It's so powerful, so primitive.
I felt some of the air escape from the room, leaving it unnaturally quiet.
You don't mean primitive, I said.
Yes, primitive. No one has told you, brother, that at times you have tom-toms beating in your voice?
My God, I laughed. I thought that was the beat of my profound ideas.
Oh, of course, you're correct, she said. I don't mean really primitive. I suppose I mean forceful, powerful. It takes hold of one's emotions as well as one's intellect. Call it what you will, it has so much naked power that it goes straight through one. I tremble just to think of such vitality.
I looked at her so close now that I could see a single jet-black strand of out-of-place hair. Yes, I said, the emotion is there, but it's actually our scientific approach that releases it. As Brother Jack says, we're nothing if not organizers, and the emotion isn't merely released, it's guided, channelized. That is the real source of our effectiveness. After all, this very good wine can release emotion, but I doubt seriously that it can organize anything.
She leaned gracefully forward, her arm along the back of the sofa, saying, Yes, and you do both in your speeches. One just has to respond, even when one isn't too clear as to your meaning. Only I do know what you're saying, and that's even more inspiring.
Actually, you know, I'm as much affected by the audience as it is by me. Its response helps me do my best.
And there's another important aspect, she said, one which concerns me greatly. It provides women with the full opportunity for self-expression, which is so very important, brother. It's as though every day were leap year, which is as it should be. Women should be absolutely as free as men.
And if I were really free, I thought, lifting my glass, I'd get the hell out of here.
I thought you were exceptionally good tonight. It's time the woman had a champion in the movement. Until tonight, I'd always heard you on minority problems.
This is a new assignment, I said. But from now on, one of our main concerns is to be the woman question.
That's wonderful, and it's about time. Something has to give women an opportunity to come to close grips with life. Please, go on. Tell me your ideas, she said, pressing forward her hand light upon my arm.
And I went on talking, relieved to talk, carried away by my own enthusiasm and by the warmth of the wine. And it was only when I turned to ask a question of her that I realized that she was leaning only a nose tip away, her eyes upon my face.
Go on, please, go on, I heard. You make it sound so clear. Please.
I saw the rapid moth-wing fluttering of her lids become the softness of her lips as we were drawn together. There was not an idea or concept in it, but sheer warmth. Then the bell was ringing, and I shook it off and got to my feet, hearing it ring again as she arose with me, the red robe falling in heavy folds upon the carpet, and she saying,
You make it all so wonderfully alive,
as the bell sounded again. And I was trying to move, to get out of the apartment, looking for my hat and filling with anger, thinking, Is she crazy? Doesn't she hear? As she stood before me in bewilderment, as though I were acting irrationally, and now taking my arm with sudden energy, saying, This way, in here, almost pulling me along as the bell rang again, through a door, down a short hall, a satiny bedroom, in which she stood appraising me with a smile, saying,
This is mine.
As I looked at her in outrageous disbelief,
Yours? Yours? But what about that bell?
Never mind, she cooed, looking into my eyes. But be reasonable, I said, pushing her aside. What about the door?
Oh, of course, you mean the telephone, don't you, darling?
But your old man, your husband,
in Chicago? But he might not. No, no, darling, he won't. But he might. But, brother, darling, I talked with him. I know. You what? What kind of game is this? Oh, you poor darling. It isn't a game. Really, you have no cause to worry. We're free. He's in Chicago seeking his lost youth, no doubt. She said, bursting into laughter of self-surprise. He's not at all interested in uplifting things. Freedom and necessity, women's rights and all that. You know, the sickness of our class. Brother, darling.
I took a step across the room. There was another door to my left through which I saw the gleam of chromium and tile.
Brotherhood, darling, she said, gripping my biceps with her little hands. Teach me. Talk to me. Teach me the beautiful ideology of brotherhood.
And I wanted both to smash her and to stay with her, and I knew that I should do neither. Was she trying to ruin me? Or was this a trap set by some secret enemy of the movement waiting outside the door with cameras and wrecking bars? You should answer the phone, I said with forced calm, trying to release my hands without touching her, for if I touched her.
And you'll continue, she said.
I nodded, seeing her turn without a word and go toward a vanity with a large oval mirror, taking up an ivory telephone. And in the mirrored instant, I saw myself standing between her eager form and a huge, white bed. Myself caught in a guilty stance, my face taut, tie dangling. And behind the bed, another mirror, which now, like a surge of the sea, tossed our images back and forth, furiously multiplying the time and the place and the circumstance. My vision seemed to pulse alternately clear and vague, driven by a furious bellows as her lips said soundlessly, I'm sorry, and then impatiently into the telephone, yes, this is she, and then to me again, smiling as she covered the mouthpiece with her hand. It's only my sister. It'll only take a second. And my mind whirled with forgotten stories of male servants summoned to wash the mistress's back, chauffeurs sharing the master's wives, Pullman porters invited into the drawing room of rich wives headed for Reno, thinking, but this is the movement, the brotherhood. And now I saw her smile, saying, yes, Gwen, dear, yes. As one free hand went up as though to smooth her hair, and in one swift motion the red robe swept aside like a veil. And I went breathless at the petite and generously curved nude, framed, delicate and firm, in the glass. It was like a dream interval, and in an instant it swung back, and I saw only her mysteriously smiling eyes above the rich red robe. I was heading for the door, torn between anger and fierce excitement, hearing the phone click down as I started past and feeling her swirl against me, and I was lost. For the conflict between the ideological and the biological, duty and desire, had become too subtly confused. I went to her thinking, let them break down the door, whosoever will, let them come. I didn't know whether I was awake or dreaming. It was dead quiet, yet I was certain that there had been a noise and that it had come from across the room as she, beside me, made a soft sighing sound. It was strange. My mind revolved. I was chased out of a chinkapin woods by a bull. I ran up a hill. The whole hill heaved. I heard the sound and looked up to see the man looking straight at me from where he stood in the dim light of the hall, looking in with neither interest nor surprise, his face expressionless, his eyes staring. There was the sound of even breathing. Then I heard her stir beside me.
Oh, hello, dear, she said, her voice sounding far away. Back so soon?
Yes, he said. Wake me early. I have a lot to do.
I'll remember, dear, she said sleepily. Have a good night's rest.
Night? And you too, he said with a short, dry laugh. The door closed. I lay there in the dark for a while, breathing rapidly.
Was strange.
I reached out and touched her. There was no answer. I leaned over her, feeling her breath breezing warm and pure against my face. I wanted to linger there, experiencing the sensation of something precious, perilously attained too late, and now to be lost forever. A poignancy. But it was as though
She'd never been awake, and if she should awaken now, she'd scream, shriek. I slid hurriedly from the bed, keeping my eye on that part of the darkness from where the light had come, as I tried to find my clothes. I blundered around, finding a chair, an empty chair. Where were my clothes? What a fool! Why had I gotten myself into such a situation? I felt my way naked through the darkness, found the chair with my clothes, dressed hurriedly, and slipped out, halting only at the door to look back through the dim light from the hall. She slept without sigh or smile. A beautiful dreamer, one ivory arm flung above her jet-black head. My heart pounded as I closed the door and went down the hall, expecting the man, men, crowds, to halt me. Then I was taking the stairs. The building was quiet. In the lobby, the doorman dozed, his starched bib buckling beneath his chin with his breathing, his white head bare. I reached the street limp with perspiration, still unsure whether I had seen the man or had dreamed him. Could I have seen him without his seeing me? Or again, had he seen me and been silent out of sophistication, decadence, over civilization? I hurried down the street, my anxiety growing with each step. Why hadn't he said something, recognized me, cursed me, attacked me, or at least been outraged with her? What if it were a test to discover how I would react to such pressure? It was, after all, a point upon which our enemies would attack us violently. I walked in a sweat of agony. Why did they have to mix their women into everything? Between us and everything we wanted to change in the world, they placed a woman, socially, politically, economically. Why, goddammit, why did they insist upon confusing the class struggle with the ass struggle, debasing both us and them, all human motives? All the next day I was in a state of exhaustion, waiting tensely for the plan to be revealed. Now I was certain that the man had been in the doorway, a man with a briefcase who had looked in and given no definite sign that he had seen me. A man who had spoken like an indifferent husband, but who yet seemed to recall to me some important member of the Brotherhood. Someone so familiar that my failure to identify him was driving me almost to distraction. My work lay untouched before me. Each ring of the telephone filled me with dread. I toyed with Tarp's leg chain. If they don't call by 4 o'clock, I'm saved, I told myself. But still no sign, not even a call to a meeting. Finally, I rang her number, hearing her voice delighted, gay, and discreet, but no mention of the night or the man. And hearing her so composed and gay, I was too embarrassed to bring it up. Perhaps this was the sophisticated and civilized way. Perhaps he was there and they had an understanding, a woman with full rights. Would I return for further discussion, she wanted to know. Yes, of course, I said. Oh, brother, she said. I hung up with a mixture of relief and anxiety, unable to shrug off the notion that I had been tested and had failed. I went through the next week puzzling over it, and even more confused because I knew nothing definite of where I stood. I tried to detect changes in my relations with Brother Jack and the others, but they gave no sign. And even if they had, I wouldn't have known its definite meaning, for it might have had to do with the charges. I was caught between guilt and innocence, so that now they seemed one and the same. My nerves were in a state of constant tension. My face took on a stiff, non-committal expression, beginning to look like Brother Jack's and the other leaders. Then I relaxed a bit. Work had to be done, and I would play the waiting game. And despite my guilt and uncertainty, I learned to forget that I was a lone, guilty black brother, and to go striding confidently into a room full of whites. It was chin up, a not-too-wide-stretched smile, the out-thrust hand for the firm, warm handshake, and with it just the proper mixture of arrogance and down-to-earth humility to satisfy all. I threw myself into the lectures, defending, asserting the rights of women, and though the girls continued to buzz around, I was careful to keep the biological and the ideological carefully apart, which wasn't always easy, for it was as though many of the sisters were agreed among themselves, and I assumed that I accepted it, that the ideological was merely a superfluous veil for the real concerns of life.
I found that most downtown audiences seemed to expect some unnamed something whenever I appeared. I could sense it the moment I stood before them, and it had nothing to do with anything I might say, for I had merely to appear before them, and from the moment they turned their eyes upon me, they seemed to undergo a strange unburdening, not of laughter, nor of tears, nor of any stable, unmixed emotion. I didn't get it, and my guilt was aroused. Once, in the middle of a passage, I looked into the sea of faces and thought, "Do they know? Is that it?" and almost ruined my lecture. But of one thing I was certain. It was not the same attitude they held for certain other black brothers who entertained them with stories so often that they laughed even before these fellows opened their mouths. No, it was something else. A form of expectancy, a mood of waiting, hoping for something like justification, as though they expected me to be more than just another speaker or an entertainer. Something seemed to occur that was hidden from my own consciousness. I acted out a pantomime more eloquent than my most expressive words. I was a partner to it, but could no more fathom it than I could the mystery of the man in the doorway. Perhaps, I told myself, it's in your voice, after all. In your voice and in their desire to see in you a living proof of their belief in brotherhood. And to ease my mind, I stopped thinking about it. Then one night, when I had fallen asleep while making notes for a new series of lectures, the phone summoned me to an emergency meeting at headquarters, and I left the house with feelings of dread. This is it, I thought. Either the charges or the women. To be tripped up by a woman. What would I say to them? That she was irresistible and I human? What had that to do with responsibility, with building brotherhood? It was all I could do to make myself go. I arrived late. The room was sweltering. Three small fans stirred the heavy air, and the brothers sat in their shirt sleeves around a scarred table upon which a pitcher of ice water glistened with beads of moisture. "Brothers, I'm sorry I'm late," I apologized. There were some important last-minute details concerning tomorrow's lecture that kept me. "Then you might have saved yourself the trouble and the committee this lost time," Brother Jack said. "I don't understand you," I said, suddenly feverish.
"He means that you are no longer to concern yourself with the woman question. That's ended," Brother Tobit said,
and I braced myself for the attack. But before I could respond, Brother Jack fired a startling question at me.
"What has become of Brother Todd Clifton?"
"Brother Clifton? Why, I haven't seen him in weeks. I've been too busy downtown here. What's happened?"
"He has disappeared," Brother Jack said. "Disappeared. So don't waste time with superfluous questions. You weren't sent for that."
"But how long has this been known?" Brother Jack struck the table.
"All we know is that he's gone. Let's get on with our business. You, brother, ought to return to Harlem immediately. We're facing a crisis there, since Brother Todd Clifton has not only disappeared but failed in his assignment. On the other hand, Ross the Exhorter and his gang of racist gangsters are taking advantage of this and are increasing their agitation. You ought to get back there and take measures to regain our strength in the community. You'll be given the forces you'll need, and you'll report to us for a strategy meeting about which you'll be notified tomorrow. And please," he emphasized with his gavel, "be on time."
I was so relieved that none of my own problems were discussed that I didn't linger to ask if the police had been consulted about the disappearance. Something was wrong with the whole deal, for Clifton was too responsible and had too much to gain simply to have disappeared. Did it have any connection with Rost the Exhorter? That seemed unlikely. Harlem was one of our strongest districts, and just a month ago when I was shifted, Ross would have been laughed off the street had he tried to attack us. If only I hadn't been so careful not to offend the committee, I would have kept in closer contact with Clifton and the whole Harlem membership. Now, it was as though I had been suddenly awakened from a deep sleep. I had been away long enough for the streets to seem strange. The uptown rhythms were slower and yet were somehow faster. A different tension was in the hot night air. I made my way through the summer crowds, not to the district, but to Barrel House's Jolly Dollar, a dark hole of a bar and grill
on Upper 8th Avenue, where one of my best contacts, Brother Maceo, could usually be found about this time having his evening's beer. Looking through the window, I could see men in working clothes and a few rummy women leaning at the bar. Down the aisle between the bar and the counter were a couple of men in black and blue checked sport shirts eating barbecue. A cluster of men and women hovered near the jukebox at the rear. But when I went in, Brother Maceo wasn't among them, and I pushed to the bar, deciding to wait over a beer. "Good evening, brothers," I said, finding myself between two men whom I'd seen around before, only to have them look at me oddly, the eyebrows of the tall one rising at a drunken angle as he looked at the other.
"Shit," the tall man said. "You said it, man. He's a relative of yon. Shit, he goddamn sure ain't no kin of mine."
I turned and looked at them, the room suddenly clouding.
"He must be drunk," the second man said. "Maybe he thinks he's kin to you. Then his whiskey telling him a damn lie. I wouldn't be his kin even if I was. Hey, Barrel House."
I moved away down the bar, looking at them out of a feeling of suspense. They didn't sound drunk, and I had said nothing to offend, and I was certain that they knew who I was. What was it? The brotherhood greeting was as familiar as, "Give me some skin," or "Peace, it's wonderful." I saw Barrel House rolling down from the other end of the bar, his white apron indented by the tension of its cord so that it looked like the kind of metal beer barrel which has a groove around its middle. And seeing me now, he began to smile.
"Well, I'll be damned if it ain't the good brother," he said, stretching out his hand. "Brother, where you been keeping yourself?"
"I've been working downtown," I said, feeling a surge of gratitude.
"Fine, fine," Barrel House said.
"Business good?"
"I'd rather not discuss it, brother. Business is bad, very bad."
"I'm sorry to hear it. You better give me a beer," I said, "after you've served these gentlemen." I watched them in the mirror.
"Sure thing,"
Barrel House said, reaching for a glass and drawing a beer.
"What you putting down, old man?" he said to the tall man. "Look here, Barrel. We wanted to ask you one question," the tall one said. "We just wanted to know if you could tell us just whose brother this here cat's supposed to be. Now, he come in here just calling everybody brother." "He's my brother," Barrel said, holding the foaming glass between his fingers. "Anything wrong with that?"
"Look, fella," I said down the bar, "that's our way of speaking. I meant no harm in calling you brother. I'm sorry. You misunderstood me."
"Brother, here's your beer," Barrel House said.
"So he's your brother, eh, Barrel?"
Barrel's eyes narrowed as he pressed his huge chest across the bar, looking suddenly sad.
"You enjoying yourself, McAdams," he said gloomily. "You like your beer?"
"Show,"
McAdams said.
"It cold enough."
"Show, but Barrel."
"You like the groovy music on the jukebox," Barrel said.
"Hell yes, but..."
"And you like a good, clean, sociable atmosphere?"
"Show, but that ain't what I'm talking about," the man said.
"Yeah, but that's what I'm talking about," Barrel House said mournfully. "And if you like it, and don't start trying to bug my other customers. This here man's done more for the community than you'll ever do."
"What community?"
McAdams said, cutting his eyes around toward me.
"I hear he got the white fever and left."
"You liable to hear anything," Barrel House said. "There's some paper back there in the gents' room. You ought to wipe out your ears."
"Never mind my ears."
"Oh, come on, Mac," his friend said. "Forget it. Ain't the man done apologized?"
"I said never mind my ears," McAdams said. "You just tell your brother he ought to be careful about who he claims as kinfolk. Some of us don't think so much about his kind of politics."
I looked from one to the other. I considered myself beyond the stage of street fighting, and one of the worst things I could do upon returning to the community was to engage in a brawl. I looked at McAdams and was glad when the other man pushed him down the bar.
"That McAdams thinks he's tight," Barrel House said. "He's the kind can't nobody please. Be frank, though, there's lots feel like that now."
I shook my head in bafflement. I'd never met that kind of antagonism before. "What's happened to Brother Maceo?" I said.
"I don't know, brother. He don't come in so regular these days. Things are kind of changing up here. Ain't much money floating around.
Times are hard everywhere, but what's been going on up here, Barrow? I said.
Oh, you know how it is, brother. Things are tight. Lots of people who got jobs through you people have lost them. And you know how it goes.
You mean people in our organization?
Quite a few of them are. Fellows like Brother Maceo.
But why? They were doing all right.
Sure they was, as long as you people was fighting for them. The minute y'all stopped, they started throwing folks out on the street.
I looked at him, big and sincere before me.
It was unbelievable that the Brotherhood had stopped its work, and yet he wasn't lying.
Give me another beer, I said. Then someone called him from the back, and he drew the beer and left. I drank it slowly, hoping Brother Maceo would appear before I had finished. When he didn't, I waved to Barrel House and left for the district. Perhaps Brother Tarp could explain, or at least tell me something about Clifton. I walked through the dark block over to 7th and started down. Things were beginning to look serious. Along the way, I saw not a single sign of Brotherhood activity. In a hot side street, I came upon a couple striking matches along the curb, kneeling as though looking for a lost coin, the matches flaring dimly in their faces. Then, I found myself in a strangely familiar block and broke out in a sweat. I had almost walked to Mary's door, and turned now and hurried away. Barrel House had prepared me for the darkened windows of the district, but not when I let myself in to call in vain through the dark to Brother Tarp. I went to the room where he slept, but he was not there. Then I went through the dark hall to my old office and threw myself into my desk chair, exhausted. Everything seemed to be slipping away from me, and I could find no quick absorbing action that would get it under control. I tried to think of whom among the district committee I might call for information concerning Clifton, but here again I was balked, for if I selected one who believed that I had requested to be transferred because I hated my own people, it would only complicate matters. No doubt there would be some who'd resent my return, so it was best to confront them all at once without giving any one of them the opportunity to organize any sentiment against me. It was best that I talk with Brother Tarp, whom I trusted. When he came in, he could give me an idea of the state of affairs, and perhaps tell me what had actually happened to Clifton. But Brother Tarp didn't arrive. I went out and got a container of coffee and returned to spend the night poring over the district's records. When he hadn't returned by 3 a.m., I went to his room and took a look around. It was empty. Even the bed was gone. I'm all alone, I thought. A lot has occurred about which I wasn't told, something that had not only stifled the members' interest, but which, according to the records, had sent them away in droves. Barrel House had said that the organization had quit fighting, and that was the only explanation I could find for Brother Tarp's leaving. Unless, of course, he'd had disagreements with Clifton or some of the other leaders. And now, returning to my desk, I noticed his gift of Douglas's portrait was gone. I felt in my pocket for the leg chain. At least I hadn't forgotten to take that along. I pushed the records aside. They told me nothing of why things were as they were. Picking up the telephone, I called Clifton's number, hearing it ring on and on. Finally, I gave it up and went to sleep in my chair. Everything had to wait until the strategy meeting. Returning to the district was like returning to a city of the dead. Somewhat to my surprise, there were a good number of members in the hall when I awoke, and having no directives from the committee on how to proceed, I organized them into teams to search for Brother Clifton. Not one could give me any definite information. Brother Clifton had appeared at the district as usual up to the time of his disappearance. There had been no quarrels with committee members, and he was as popular as ever. Nor had there been any clashes with Ross the Exhorter, although in the past week he had been increasingly active. As for the loss of membership and influence, it was a result of a new program which had called for the shelving of our old techniques of agitation. There had been, to my surprise, a switch in emphasis from local issues to those more national and international in scope, and it was felt that for the moment the interests of Harlan were not of first importance. I didn't know what to make of it, since there had been no such change of program downtown. Clifton was forgotten. Everything which I
was to do now seemed to depend upon getting an explanation from the committee, and I waited with growing agitation to be called to the strategy meeting. Such meetings were usually held around 1 o'clock, and we were notified well ahead. But by 11:30, I received no word, and I became worried. By 12, an uneasy sense of isolation took hold of me. Something was cooking, but what? How? Why? Finally, I phoned headquarters, but could reach none of the leaders. What is this, I wondered. Then I called the leaders of other districts, with the same results. And now I was certain that the meeting was being held. But why without me? Had they investigated Restrom's charges and decided they were true? It seemed that the membership had fallen off after I had gone downtown, or was it the woman? Whatever it was, now was not the time to leave me out of a meeting. Things were too urgent in the district. I hurried down to headquarters. When I arrived, the meeting was in session, just as I expected, and word had been left that it was not to be disturbed by anyone. It was obvious that they hadn't forgotten to notify me. I left the building in a rage. Very well, I thought, when they do decide to call me, they'll have to find me. I should have never been shifted in the first place, and now that I was sent back to clean up the mess, they should aid me as quickly as possible. I would do no more running downtown, nor would I accept any program that they sent up without consulting the Harlem Committee. Then I decided, of all things, to shop for a pair of new shoes and walked over to Fifth Avenue. It was hot. The walk still filled with the noontime crowds moving with reluctance back to their jobs. I moved along close to the curb to avoid the bumping and agitated changes of pace, the chattering women in summer dresses. Finally, entering the leather-smelling, air-cooled interior of the shoe store with a sense of relief. My feet felt light in the new summer shoes as I went back into the blazing heat, and I recalled the old boyhood pleasure of discarding winter shoes for sneakers, and the neighborhood foot races that always followed, that light-footed, speedy, floating sensation. Well, I thought, you've run your last foot race, and you'd better get back to the district in case you're called. And I hurried now, my feet feeling trim and light as I moved through the oncoming rush of sun-beaten faces. To avoid the crowd on 42nd Street, I turned off at 43rd, and it was here that things began to boil. A small fruit wagon with an array of bright peaches and pears stood near the curb, and the vendor, a florid man with bulbous nose and bright black Italian eyes, looked at me knowingly from beneath his huge white and orange umbrella, then over toward a crowd that had formed alongside the building across the street. What's wrong with him, I thought. Then I was across the street and passing the group standing with their backs to me. A clipped, insinuating voice spieled words whose meaning I couldn't catch, and I was about to pass on when I saw the boy. He was a slender brown fellow whom I recognized immediately as a close friend of Clifton's, and who now was looking intently across the tops of cars to where down the block near the post office on the other side a tall policeman was approaching. Perhaps he'll know something, I thought, as he looked around to see me and stopped in confusion. Hello there, I began, and when he turned toward the crowd and whistled, I didn't know whether he was telling me to do the same or signaling to someone else. I swung around, seeing him step to where a large carton sat beside the building and sling its canvas straps to his shoulder as once more he looked toward the policeman, ignoring me. Puzzled, I moved into the crowd and pressed to the front where at my feet I saw a square piece of cardboard upon which something was moving with furious action. It was some kind of toy, and I glanced at the crowd's fascinated eyes and down again, seeing it clearly this time. I'd seen nothing like it before. A grinning doll of orange and black tissue paper with thin, flat cardboard discs forming its head and feet, and which some mysterious mechanism was causing to move up and down in a loose-jointed, shoulder-shaking, infuriatingly sensuous motion, a dance that was completely detached from the black, mask-like face. It's no jumping jack, but what, I thought, seeing the doll throwing itself about with the fierce defiance of someone performing a degrading act in public, dancing as though it received a perverse pleasure from its motions.
and beneath the chuckles of the crowd I could hear the swishing of its ruffled paper, while the same out-of-the-corner-of-the-mouth voice continued to spiel.
"Shake it up! Shake it up! He's Sambo, the dancing doll, ladies and gentlemen. Shake him, stretch him by the neck and set him down. He'll do the rest. Yes, he'll make you laugh. He'll make you sigh, sigh. He'll make you want to dance and dance. Here you are, ladies and gentlemen, Sambo, the dancing doll. Buy one for your baby. Take him to your girlfriend and she'll love you, love you. He'll keep you entertained. He'll make you weep. Sweet tears from laughing. Shake him, shake him. You cannot break him, for he's Sambo the dancing, Sambo the prancing, Sambo the entrancing, Sambo boogie woogie paper doll. And all for 25 cents, the quarter part of a dollar, ladies and gentlemen. He'll bring you joy. Step up and meet him, Sambo the..."
I knew I should get back to the district, but I was held by the inanimate, boneless bouncing of the grinning doll and struggled between the desire to join in the laughter and to leap upon it with both feet. When it suddenly collapsed, and I saw the tip of the spieler's toe press upon the circular cardboard that formed the feet, and a broad black hand came down, its fingers deftly lifting the doll's head and stretching it upward twice its length, then releasing it to dance again. And suddenly the voice didn't go with the hand. It was as though I had waded out into a shallow pool only to have the bottom drop out and the water close over my head. I looked up. "Not you," I began. But his eyes looked past me, deliberately unseeing. I was paralyzed, looking at him, knowing I wasn't dreaming, hearing... "What makes him happy? What makes him dance? This Sambo, this Jambo, this high-steppin' joy boy. He's more than a toy, ladies and gentlemen. He's Sambo, the dancing doll, the 20th century miracle. Look at that rumba, that Susie Q. He's Sambo boogie, Sambo woogie. You don't have to feed him. He sleeps collapsed. He'll kill your depression and your dispossession. He lives upon the sunshine of your lordly smile. And only 25 cents, the brotherly 2 bits of a dollar, just because he wants me to eat. It gives him pleasure to see me eat. You simply take him and shake him, and he does the rest. Thank you, lady."
It was Clifton, riding easily back and forth on his knees, flexing his legs without shifting his feet, his right shoulder raised at an angle, and his arm pointing stiffly at the bouncing doll as he spieled from the corner of his mouth. The whistle came again, and I saw him glance quickly toward his lookout, the boy with the carton.
"Who else wants little Sambo before we take it on the Lambo? Speak up, ladies and gentlemen. Who wants little..."
And again the whistle.
"Who wants Sambo, the dancing, prancing? Hurry, hurry, ladies and gentlemen. There's no license for little Sambo, the joy spreader. You can't tax joy, so speak up, ladies and gentlemen."
And for a second, our eyes met, and he gave me a contemptuous smile. Then he spieled again. I felt betrayed. I looked at the doll and felt my throat constrict. The rage welled behind the phlegm as I rocked back on my heels and crouched forward. There was a flash of whiteness and a splatter like heavy rain striking a newspaper, and I saw the doll go over backwards, wilting into a dripping rag of frilled tissue. The hateful head turned upward on its outstretched neck, still grinning toward the sky. The crowd turned on me indignantly. The whistle came again. I saw a short, pot-bellied man look down, then up at me with amazement and explode with laughter, pointing from me to the doll, rocking. People backed away from me. I saw Clifton step close to the building where, beside the fellow with the carton, I now saw a whole chorus line of dolls flouncing themselves with a perverse increase of energy and the crowd laughing hysterically.
"You? You?"
I began, only to see him pick up 2 of the dolls and step forward, but now the lookout came close. "He's coming," he said, nodding toward the approaching policeman as he swept up the dolls, dropping them into the carton and starting away.
"Follow little Sambo around the corner, ladies and gentlemen," Clifton called. "There's a great show coming up."
It happened so fast that in a second only I and an old lady in a blue polka-dot dress were left. She looked at me, then back to the walk, smiling. I saw one of the dolls. She was still smiling, and I raised my foot to crush it, hearing her cry, "Oh, no!" The policeman was just opposite, and I reached down instead, picking it up and walking off in the same motion. I examined it strangely, weightless in my hand, half expecting to feel it pulse with life. It was a still frill of paper.
I dropped it in the pocket where I carried Brother Tarp's chain link and started after the vanished crowd. But I couldn't face Clifton again. I didn't want to see him. I might forget myself and attack. I went in the other direction towards Sixth Avenue, past the policeman. What a way to find him, I thought. What had happened to Clifton? It was all so wrong, so unexpected. How on earth could he drop from Brotherhood to this in so